Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute on this rainy day. Nicholas Haslach is here, and he's going to talk on the topic Sir Paul Haslach and the Menzies Era. I'll introduce him briefly. It's on the occasion of the launch of his latest novel, The Bradshaw Case, and we've got some copies of that here. We've also got some copies of the late Geoffrey Bolton, who addressed the Institute some years ago, Paul Haslach Alive. So that's here as well. And I'll introduce our speaker. Nicholas Haslach practiced law in Perth for many years while turning his hand to literary works in various genres. He ended up his legal career as a judge of the Supreme Court of Western Australia. His novel, The Melamine Jug, won the Age Book of the Year Award, and he has been twice shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Prize. Nicholas has served as chair of the Literature Board of Australia Council and of the Commonwealth Writers Prize. But tonight he's here to talk about Sir Paul Haslach and the Menzies Era. Nicholas Haslach, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and it's a pleasure to be here, indeed a privilege to be here at the Sydney Institute. Now, coming straight to the topic, the former Prime Minister, John Howard, as you know, has added to his list of achievements by revisiting the life and times of Sir Robert Menzies. He has done so by hosting a television series and by writing a book called The Menzies Era. The author is quick to remind us that having served briefly as Prime Minister in the war years, Menzies went on to serve as Prime Minister for a further period of 16 years from the election of the Liberal Country Party coalition in 1949 to retirement at a time of his choosing in January 1966. The era in question is defined by John Howard to include the next 7 years, so as to end with the coalition's defeat at the polls in 1972, 23 years of continuous rule, which are described in the Howard book subtitle as, quote, the years that shaped modern Australia, unquote. Now, this evening, I seek to cast further light on the Menzies era by reviewing the book from the vantage point of my late father, Sir Paul Haslach, who was not only a long-standing cabinet colleague of Menzies and his successors, but also a former journalist and a shrewd observer of the political scene. In doing so, I will draw principally upon Geoffrey Bolton's recently published biography that Gerard has just mentioned, Paul Haslach, A Life, and some of Haslach's own works, such as The Chance of Politics, a collection of pieces about his political contemporaries that I edited some years ago. John Howard's book is a fine account of the era. He mentions improved standards of living, rising home ownership, national development, the opening up of trading opportunities in Asia, progress in education, the CETO and ANZUS treaties, and he provides also a judicious account of Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War. He sets the record straight as to various political myths. For example, Gough Whitlam's historic victory in 1972, which ended the Menzies era, was not a landslide of epic proportions, as commonly supposed by many of Whitlam's admirers. Some parts of Australia actually saw a swing to the coalition parties. In fact, they gained 2 seats in my own state of Western Australia. Now, having acknowledged the strengths of Howard's magisterial survey, it seems to me, from the vantage point from which I speak, that much more could have been said about the first phase of the era and about two areas of governmental activity which were of particular interest to Paul Hasluck, namely Aboriginal affairs and the development of Papua and New Guinea. Let me begin with a quick overview of Paul Hasluck's career. He was born in Fremantle in 1905. Having won a scholarship to Perth Modern School, he worked as a journalist on the West Australian newspaper Between the Wars. This included a period in the Kimberley region while he covered the Moseley Commission's inquiry into the treatment of Aboriginals, a secondment that led to the writing of his first book, Black Australians, published in 1940. A chance encounter with a fellow West Australian journalist, John Curtin, who was about to succeed Menzies as Prime Minister, led to Hasluck joining the Department of External Affairs in Canberra. After the war, as a member of the Australian Mission to the newly formed United Nations, Hasluck worked closely with the Foreign Minister, or Minister of External Affairs, Dr. Evatt, but felt obliged to resign eventually when the Labor Minister's practice of favouring certain subordinates became intolerable. Hasluck was then commissioned to write what became two volumes in the official war history, The Government and the People. It was in this role that he interviewed Robert Menzies, now leader of the opposition and founder of the newly formed Liberal Party. Years later, Hasluck recalled, and I quote, "Menzies was singular among all those I interviewed. Unlike all the others, he had not prepared a long typewritten screed of self-justification. He was ready to talk, answer questions, and discuss past events, and the way in which he was singular was that he stood off and talked about the events and himself as though he was observing them from outside," unquote. It seemed to Paul Hasluck that this quality was the mark of a sound education and of a superior mind. In writing the war history, Hasluck could see that the results obtained by Curtin after the Japanese attack at the end of 1941 were the direct outcome of the work done by Menzies in the two previous years, as Curtin himself acknowledged. He could see also that it was largely due to Menzies that the Liberal Party was produced out of a confused medley of political groupings in Parliament. Not surprisingly, Hasluck was soon persuaded to join the Liberal Party, and this led him to entering the Federal Parliament and the Menzies ministry in due course as a consequence of the coalition's success in the 1949 election. Still affronted by Evatt's questionable habits, Hasluck was impressed by the new Prime Minister's reformative approach to the institutions of government upon taking office. Hasluck said of this period, and I quote, "After he came to office in 1949, one of the lesser but nevertheless important achievements of Menzies was in restoring some of the dignity of Parliament and respect for it as an institution. Similarly, Menzies knew, respected, and used the public service. It was Menzies who was largely responsible for seeing that the Commonwealth Public Service was re-established after the war as an efficient, non-partisan, and self-respecting institution. This was among his major achievements," unquote. In making these and other comments about the structure of government, Hasluck spoke as an informed observer. He served as Minister for Territories in the Menzies government from 1951 to 1963, as Minister for External Affairs under Menzies, Holt and Gorton from 1964 to 1969, and as Governor-General from 1969 to 1974, working with Gorton, McMahon and Whitlam in that role. Hasluck had been looking at government in Australia for over 50 years from a number of different levels, as a member of the press gallery, as an academic historian, and from successive posts within the Citadel as a public servant, parliamentarian, cabinet minister, and eventually as president of the Executive Council. He had worked with leaders from further afield at the United Nations and as Minister for External Affairs. This background of experience adds weight to his assessment of the scene. Now, by the time John Howard reached the highest office in the 1990s, the nature of the public service had changed. principally due to reforms initiated during the Whitlam, Fraser and Hawke-Keating eras. It is not quite clear to what extent Howard sees merit in the traditional view reinstated by Menzies in the post-war period that public servants should be capable of serving successive governments and of tendering advice without fear or favour, regardless of which party had gained power. In an article contributed to Quadrant in March 1986, prior to John Howard's accession, Hasluck said this, quote, "Gradually, in the succession of Holt, Gorton and McMahon, the Prime Ministerial staff began to sprout more shoots, and then under Whitlam it came to full bloom with the construction of a presidential bureau with advisers, consultants, research assistants, speechwriters and persons with special duties over a wide range of affairs. A large number of these came from outside the public service. Fraser's only flattery of Whitlam was imitation of his presidential bureau. At the coming of Hawke, the new pattern of presidential bureau was already laid down, although structure, numbers and working methods might change to suit the style of each incumbent. This seems to me where politicisation has already begun." Unquote. Now, one has only to look at Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, written by Keating's well-known speechwriter Don Watson, to know that the spread of staffers and the process of politicisation continued apace. Watson tells a gripping but deeply disturbing tale. Watson's feverish protagonists seem to spend most of their mornings looking for whatever their opponents put out before breakfast, and most of their afternoons gunning it down in time for the evening news. Adrift in Disneyland, they seem to spend little time at looking what has to be done in the real world. Howard is well aware that, unlike the slower-paced Menzies era, confronting the enemy at high noon, nailing the 24-hour news cycle, is now at the centre of modern politics. As to the increase in staffers, many of whom are party political activists, Howard notes aptly that, quote, "this development has played a significant role in entrenching factionalism on both sides of politics," unquote. John Howard's appraisal doesn't sit altogether comfortably with the view he expresses a little later that in many areas the public service continues to be the source of frank and fearless advice to ministers. Factual feuds, bleeding hearts, there is more than enough in all of this to suggest that for many staffers, sound bites and gotcha moments at high noon are the real world. Now, amidst the mayhem, one begins to doubt that much of what happens in ministerial offices is recorded methodically. Historians in times to come may be left with little more than a heap of disjointed emails to draw upon and the ruminations of transient apparatchiks, minions in the mould of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who knew that they were in the thick of things at Prince Hamlet's court, but never quite knew what was actually going on. There has always been a tendency in the writing of Australian history for the narrative to be shaped by supposedly enlightened scribes on the political left, the creators of myths almost always favourable to Labour, particularly with respect to the Whitlam era. This means that the Liberals have let themselves be deprived of credit for various achievements. Haphazard record-keeping will facilitate this tendency. Suffice it to say for the moment that John Howard's book disposes of a number of these myths and is thus a valuable corrective to the general trend. Nonetheless, as I foreshadowed in opening, certain corners of the Menzies era deserve a closer look. Howard notes that policies affecting Aboriginal Australians became an issue of public concern in the 1960s, and that, quote, "most Australians wanted to see an improvement in Aboriginal people's conditions," unquote. He deals briefly with the constitutional amendment affected by the 1967 referendum, whereby Aboriginal people were to be included in the census, and the federal parliament acquired powers in this field of governance, but apart from saying somewhat blandly that, quote, "this matter has remained part of the mainstream political debate in Australia," unquote, he says little else about that subject. This inevitably leaves an impression that nothing much was done about this in the Menzies era. Now, it is true that prior to 1967, governmental powers concerning Aboriginal peoples were principally vested in the state governments, with the federal government being responsible for the Northern Territory. There was, of course, some resemblance between policies and practices in each state, partly referable to the concept of assimilation that had been the subject of discussion at conferences before the war. That is, the notion that Aboriginal people, and especially those of part Aboriginal descent, should eventually accede to the rights and opportunities available to all Australian citizens. But throughout the country, there were, in fact, many instances of discrimination and deprivation, and thus much to be done. As a backbencher, soon after his election to the Federal Parliament in 1949, by drawing upon his earlier experience in the Kimberley and at the United Nations, Paul Hasluck spoke powerfully from the backbench about the need to improve the status and the treatment of Aboriginal people in this way, quote, "When we enter into international discussion and raise our voice, as we should raise it, in defence of human rights and the protection of human welfare, our very words are mocked by the thousands of degraded and oppressed people who crouch on the rubbish heap throughout the whole of this continent," unquote. Gough Whitlam said of this speech in later years that, quote, "it was the most thorough speech on Aborigines ever to have been delivered in the National Parliament," unquote. On the 8th of June 1950, Hasluck moved, quote, "that this House is of the opinion that the Commonwealth Government, exercising a national responsibility for the welfare of the whole Australian people, should cooperate with the state governments in measures for the social advancement as well as the protection of the Aboriginal race throughout the mainland of Australia," unquote. Unfortunately, this motion lapsed upon the double dissolution election of that year. Upon the return of the Menzies government in 1951, Hasluck was appointed Minister for Territories. He quickly convened a meeting in Canberra of state ministers and senior office bearers with a view to agreeing the line of thought reflected in the earlier motion on the grounds that due to intermarriage and movement to urban areas, assimilation was taking place in practice, save for remote communities. In the absence of the required consent, the new minister then turned to making various improvements in the Northern Territory. The time available to me does not permit a full review, but much was done, including an increased emphasis upon housing, health and education. All of that is described in Geoffrey Bolton's biography. It was not until 1961 that the Native Welfare Council, consisting of federal and state government ministers for Aboriginal Affairs, announced during Hasluck's tenure that in the view of all Australian governments, quote, "all Aborigines and part Aborigines are expected eventually to attain the same manner of living as other Australians and to live as members of a single Australian community, enjoying the same rights and privileges, accepting the same responsibilities, observing the same customs and influenced by the same beliefs, hopes and loyalties as other Australians," unquote. This was generally regarded as a laudable objective in that era. At that time, with the arrival of many European migrants, the term assimilation was viewed as a benign description of what seemed to be the norm, a means of living harmoniously in accordance with an Australian and essentially egalitarian way of life. It was against this background that some years later the 1967 referendum was approved by a large majority of the Australian people. But attitudes are constantly changing, and this was certainly true of the 1960s. The winds of change proclaimed by Harold Macmillan foreshadowed the end of colonial rule in Africa and other parts of the world. The apartheid regime in South Africa dramatised the iniquities of racial discrimination. The civil rights movement in the United States highlighted the importance of remedial legislation. Moves were afoot in the United Nations and other international forums to establish a right of self-determination for Indigenous peoples. Again, time does not permit a full review of all the factors that led eventually, by the end of the Menzies era and more extensively under Gough Whitlam, to the widespread disparagement of assimilation and those associated with it, although it is still unclear in the Australian context, a country in which many people of Aboriginal descent live in towns and cities in the same way as other Australians, what exactly is meant by self-determination. Likewise, the jury is still out as to whether the new policy has actually improved the welfare of people in remote communities, for inevitably they too are subject to the temptations of the modern world, from alcohol to mobile phones and glossy ads on television. It would be a bold person indeed who claims to have all the answers in this complex field. Progress has been made since the war ended 70 years ago, but incrementally in fits and starts. An unfortunate aspect of the ongoing debate is the way in which each generation of administrators and commentators feels obliged to disparage or even demonise the work of their predecessors. One is reminded of the prescient words of W.B. Yeats in describing those involved in Irish politics before the Great War: "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." The current penchant for disparagement may be why John Howard steered clear of Aboriginal affairs in his book. But to leave a vacuum seems unwise, for the reality is that it will soon be filled by strident voices who are determined to rewrite history to suit their own agendas. Geoffrey Bolton's biography of Paul Hasluck puts the true position succinctly, and in a way that could easily be applied to the many other people of goodwill in towns and outback areas, usually working with limited resources, who sought to change things, change the way things were. Bolton says, quote, "Hasluck achievements may be simply stated. In 1933, when he first began to take a serious interest in Aboriginal issues, every Australian state and territory excluded Aboriginal people from citizenship and placed them under restrictive and frequently degrading regulations. 30 years later, when he ended his term as Federal Minister for Territories, it was uniformly accepted that the first Australians had an inherent right to citizenship, and if some were still subject to restraints and limitations, official policy should work towards eliminating those arrangements as soon as possible. Race should not be the determinant of citizenship. As activist in the 1930s and as legislator in the 1950s and early 1960s, Hasluck was a leading agent for change. The referendum of 1967 that amended the Commonwealth Constitution to accommodate this change is remembered as a symbolic moment. It could not have taken place and would not have secured such widespread assent but for the clearing away of much of the old legislation and the attitude of minds that supported it. Paul Hasluck played an important and honourable part." Unquote. In his memoir Shades of Darkness, written in retirement, Paul Hasluck ended his account of the earlier period and the shift to self-determination as follows, and I quote, "One immediate change in method was the sudden transference of a number of fully assimilated persons of part Aboriginal descent into professional Aborigines, who, with the entitlement of having one Aboriginal among four of their grandparents, became the confident authorities on, quote, the way of their people, unquote. More seriously, another outcome was the reawakening and at times the active promotion of racial divisions and antipathies. The new policy was avoiding the fact that a return to the past is never a solution to the problems of the future. We Australians of all cultural backgrounds have a vast repair job to do in the wreckage of a people, rather than a messianic role of leading them backwards into the wilderness to dwell apart forever." Hazlack added, and I quote, "Another difference between then and now is revealed in the way the subject is discussed. The conflict has been revived, differences exaggerated, and recriminations heightened. Many coloured people seem to have less confidence in the good intentions of those in authority, and many white people have less hope for the future of Aborigines. 50 years ago, we saw the relationship of white and coloured as a social problem. An earnest effort was made to change Australian neglect and indifference towards Aborigines, to improve their conditions, and to raise their hopes for the future. We strove for the full recognition of their entitlements, legally as citizens, socially as fellow Australians," unquote. These observations bring me now to the second area of governmental action in the Menzies era, which I feel was not covered sufficiently by John Howard's book, that is, Australia's role in Papua New Guinea. Howard mentions that in January 1970, Whitlam, as leader of the opposition, travelled to Port Moresby and committed a future Labor government to the granting of full independence by 1976. He adds in a cursory way that under Whitlam's rule 4 years later, quote, "the territory received her independence before she was ready," unquote. Howard fails to give any account of the way in which the territory was administered during the preceding Menzies era, and thus brought to a point where Whitlam could cut the ribbon and be acclaimed for the spade work done by others. District commissioners, patrol officers, public servants, doctors, nurses, judges, lawyers, teachers, business people, a host of dedicated Australians working in every corner of the country throughout the Menzies era. It emerges from Geoffrey Bolton's biography that when Paul Hazlack became Minister for Territories in 1951 and assumed responsibility for the governance of Papua New Guinea, he inherited a country, quote, "extending over 475,000 square kilometres, of which only two-thirds was classified as under effective administrative control. A mountainous country covered with tropical vegetation, it was divided among more than 200 clans with no common sense of nationality and in many cases with only recent contact with the wider world," unquote. In the early post-war era, Papua New Guinea were combined as a single unit administered by Australia as a trust territory for the United Nations, which from time to time in the years that followed would send a mission to assess the country's progress towards eventual self-determination. Again, time does not permit a full account of the steps that were taken during the Menzies era to fulfil this fiduciary obligation. Suffice it to say that the provision of infrastructure, the spread of schooling and the observance of law, the gradual creation of democratic institutions and governmental systems was a memorable feat, and the more so because it led eventually to a peaceful transfer of power to the indigenous community. It is an Australian achievement which should never be forgotten. The details of the transformation, most of which had taken well before Whitlam appeared on the scene, are set out fully in Paul Hazlack's book, A Time for Building. The nature of the task is reflected in this passage, and I quote, "The year 1962 seemed to me at the time to be a turning point in the history of Papua New Guinea. Hard work below ground had been done and progress seemed to quicken. In this period, I had many occasions of encouragement in the opening of hospitals, schools, roads, bridges, and other buildings, and in little ceremonies to welcome the first fruits of one activity or another," unquote. Hazlack goes on to describe a visit to a newly opened patrol post in the mountains at Nomad, which consisted of a tiny airstrip hard to find among the clouds, and two or three native material huts perched at the edge of a cliff. Quote, "Down below, a river ran invisibly but audibly between intertwined jungle growth. A score or so of the pygmies were watching from a distance as we climbed out of our two-seater. One, a sort of spokesman, came close to us, gave a subdued greeting, and fingered my clothing in curiosity. As the two young patrol officers and I made our inspection, the men slipped quietly from one obscure place to another and looked at us from around the corner of huts. They were naked except for a tough, hard belt of bark around the soft part of the body. Each man carried a bow as tall as himself and a clutch of arrows. The pilot and I had some food and yarn with the two boys. They were completing the policy of bringing the whole of the territory under administrative control. As keenly as ever, I felt the immensity of the task that had been done over the last 10 years and was thrilled with the young Australians who had done it. Less than 3 years later, the nomad people were voting for the House of Assembly, unquote. Hasluck said this of his final years in Papua New Guinea, and I quote, "I developed a deep affection for the land and its people and had begun to develop some of the characteristics of the old hands. We had worked for this country when few others had shown much interest. We had stored up pleasant memories. I'd yarned on clear tropical evenings in remote places with those who had taken an earlier part in the exploration of Papua New Guinea and made first contact with its people. I talked with the people in their villages. I'd responded to the grandeur of its mountains and the whispering warmth of the sea on its coast. My sympathy for the indigenous people and hopes for their future had been kindled. In its own subtle way, Papua New Guinea had taken possession of me. Perhaps this showed. Perhaps some of the newcomers and one-week journalists thought I had been deluded into thinking I owned the place, when in fact I was the one who was possessed," unquote. Menzies visited Papua New Guinea on several occasions, and it seems that he responded favourably to sentiments of this kind, with the result that he and Hasluck formed a closer relationship. This probably contributed to Menzies' support for Hasluck in the contest for leadership of the Liberal Party in January 1968, when John Gordon succeeded Harold Holt as Prime Minister. So let me sum up. When I review the Menzies era from the vantage point of Paul Hasluck, a man close to Menzies and his three successors, and the holder of various public offices throughout the 23 years of continuous coalition rule, it strikes me that in certain respects John Howard's book and related TV series leave more to be said. My observation should not be construed as a critique, but simply as an attempt to add further layers to a well-researched narrative that generally manages to set the record straight. The Howard book will certainly serve as a valuable corrective to a number of myths shaped by historians and commentators on the left, who are often unwilling to acknowledge any achievements on the other side of politics. My overview is supported by the matters mentioned earlier. As to the grant of independence in Papua New Guinea, mythmakers on the left show scant respect for those who laid the foundations. They reserve their acclaim for the man who cut the ribbon. As to Aboriginal affairs, there are myths aplenty, including the notion that nothing of any importance was attempted or accomplished prior to the Whitlam era. Activists in contemporary times, by disparaging or even demonising their predecessors, have paved the way to widespread political correctness, which now makes it almost impossible to have an open discussion about Aboriginal issues and the steps that should be taken. In recent days, much to his credit, John Howard has voiced his concern about the attack on cartoonist Bill Leake for drawing attention to the disarray in some Aboriginal communities. The former Prime Minister is obviously well aware of the threat to free speech posed by Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. He himself was shaped by the Menzies era, and his links to that era are reflected in what he said. The Menzies and his successors were firm believers in the rule of law and the right of people in the community to express unusual opinions or to expose hypocrisy by skillful satire. Like many others, I hold the same view. With that in mind, I have sought to underline the link between one era and the next, the importance of free speech, by looking at reports written by anthropologists in the Kimberley when Paul Hasluck went there in the 1930s. In my recently published novel, The Bradshaw Case, which Gerard mentioned, The lawyers involved in a native title claim insist that an elderly anthropologist abandon the opinion he has held for many decades that an unusual form of rock art in the Kimberley, known as Bradshaw art or Gwian Gwian, was created not by local people but many thousands of years earlier by visitants from the Indonesian archipelago. The anthropologist refuses to comply with this insistence made by the lawyers that he drop his opinion, and in doing so he recalls the words of the contrarian Henry Thoreau, quote, "If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music he hears, however measured or far away," unquote. The tradition of free speech runs through the history of this country from its earliest days to the Menzies era and beyond. It should not be forgotten or lightly abandoned. Stifling debate by political correctness and related threats of legal action is a blind alley. Change for the better is driven by freedom of thought and achievable outcomes. Against the background of my earlier remarks, it is perhaps timely to note that the first Aboriginal member of the House of Representatives, Ken Wyatt, now a minister in the Turnbull government, represents the West Australian electorate of Hasluck. This is what Paul Hasluck and others of his generation worked for, that Aboriginal people should take their proper place in the forums of the nation. In his words, I quote again, "We strove for the full recognition of their entitlements, legally as citizens, socially as fellow Australians," unquote.
Many thanks, Nicholas Hasluck, and as I pointed out earlier, we've got some copies. Unfortunately, we invited Geoffrey Bolton to speak about this book, but he wasn't well and he died soon after at a ripe age. So we've got copies of Geoffrey Bolton's Paul Hasluck, A Life, which is a very important biography, and copies of, I think you've now done 20 books, right? But the most recent Nicholas Hasluck book, The Bradshaw Case, which is a novel. Did you say 21, did you? 20. So we've got copies of that too, and I'm sure Nicholas will be happy to sign both books. And so we come to questions and discussion. Tell us a bit about your father in the light of the apparent election of Donald Trump as President of the United States, to be confirmed. There were different personalities, weren't there? Tell us about your father, because the criticism of your father, you mentioned the point that Robert Menzies wanted him to become Liberal leader after the drowning of Harold Holt. But he didn't seem to have that kind of push and drive that would make phone calls and visit people and beg for support. And yet he was a very successful politician over the decades that you've mentioned, albeit in a quiet way through Aboriginal affairs, through Papua New Guinea. He actually had a lot of achievements, but he didn't seem to have a lot of personal drive. So is that a fair assessment of your late father, or was he really a sort of a Donald Trump and we didn't know it?
Well, I certainly don't think the latter. I think responding that, Jared, it's certainly what you put is certainly a question that has to be pondered. But as my father says or as I have as an epigraph to that book of his pieces on his contemporaries' chance of politics, he said, "I didn't have to clamber or contrive to enter politics. I was asked to participate, and I complied." So in a way, he was kind of recruited to the Liberal Party, because of his record as having been at the United Nations and so on, and the fact that he had a wide experience in governmental matters, but he was not the sort of politician who had sought office in the first place. And I think something of that remained. He was principally more interested in governance, because he had been a public service, and in some ways he was able to fulfil that role by the administrative responsibilities he had in the Northern Territory in Papua New Guinea. But as he says somewhere in one of his writings, he knew that being assigned to that portfolio was the death of him politically, because the fact of the matter is that The electorate generally wasn't hugely interested in those matters, so therefore one was not an especially prominent figure in politics in that era. And he'd started life as a journalist, as an observer, so I think, coming back to your question, I think he would be stunned and staggered by the fact that someone such as Trump, and one won't go into the full range of his personality, but he's a man apparently with no real background in politics at all. And I think that is the most astonishing thing, and I think that would astonish someone like my father, because most other presidents have come from some degree of political background, governorships or Senate, Congress, and so forth and so on. Trump doesn't have that. And of course, the great contrast with John Howard is that, I mean, John Howard is someone who had been in politics from his earliest days and knew how it worked and was in the business of bringing people along with him and persuading people to do this and that. But I suppose the fact of the matter is that my father didn't grow up in that tradition. He came to Parliament rather late, towards the end of his 40s, as many in that generation did. And I suppose it might be said that he was not a natural Machiavellian sort of figure.
Stay here, Nicholas. Lindsay.
It's dangerous and sometimes pointless to speculate on what people from an earlier era think about contemporary issues, but how would your father approach the recognition of Aborigines in the Constitution, as is proposed by some?
Question about the recognition of Aborigines in the Constitution.
Yes. Well, on this question of recognition, I mean, certainly looking at it from the vantage point of his own era at that time, he would not have been in favour of it, because the whole logic of his approach, as I've described, was that everyone on this continent should essentially be regarded as Australian citizens, and that's what the Constitution should be speaking to. But again, as I described, so many things have changed, so it's hard to say positively. I think he would have been sceptical about the benefit of proposed changes of the kind that have been canvassed. A bit as I am myself, he might possibly have been persuaded that perhaps some amendment to the preamble was justified to put a historical context, but I think he would have been firmly opposed to the notion that something resembling rights of some kind should be entrenched in a rather piecemeal way in the Constitution, which is at least one of the proposals being circulated at the moment.
Question here.
Oh, you may be pleased to know that your father cut the ribbon so as to speak to inaugurate the Indian Pacific Railroad between Sydney and Perth in February 1970. But as his term as Governor-General, what was his attitude to politics, having left in 69 and then leaving in 74 as Governor-General? What was his observations as to how to change from Menzies through to the middle of the Whitlam government?
Well, again, he speaks about some of this in A Chance of Politics, but his view was certainly of the view that there's a certain merit or a certain value in someone being Governor-General with some background in politics, because they understand how the system works. And so, and in some ways it suited his personality, because as I've just said, rather than the clambering and the contrivance of the active political scene, which brings, for which some people have an appetite, that was not his natural predilection. So I think in some ways for him to be at the heart of government, as one is as a Governor General presiding over Executive Council, and playing a part in the thing, but without the clambering and contriving, probably suited his personality. But then there is that other question. He was bringing to the job a wide range and background of political experience, and when we come to his successor, John Kerr, who came out of the judiciary, it's a question some commentators have raised, and I raise it in my own novel about that subject, Dismissal, that, you see, judges are a bit inclined to sort of hear both sides of the argument and then just make a ruling out of the privacy of their own mind. While as someone coming from a political background really knows you have to be reading all sorts of aspects of the situation, and that may have, what I've just said may or may not have played some part in Kerr's actions at the time.
So we go to Anne, and then we go to Malcolm. Is that?
You mentioned the madness of the media in being a politician today, and I grin when I see, you know, Christopher Pyne desperately trying to get his moment on reality TV and others on the opposite side the same. It seems to me, looking back on the Menzies era, that one of its qualities, as you seem to describe, was their ability to get on with government rather than spend the time in personal promotion. To what extent did you notice this in your father's career as a politician?
Oh, I think that's why he responded so much to Menzies, because, again, as I more or less imply in the paper, that my father didn't come out of a particularly political background and could have really gone to either side of politics. But the fact that Menzies had such a great clarity of mind was something that I know from talking to my father he placed great weight upon. And in a piece of writing he did on Menzies, it's in fact in my paper, but time is against me actually quoting it a moment ago, he makes the point that one of the things that always pleased him was that in cabinet, Menzies was always in the business of leading discussion, or at least responding to discussion, by determining what was right, the best way to go, considering not only the fortunes of the country, the party platform, all those things, and then deciding how you would massage it through the whole public relations and parliamentary forum. But again, in the present era, one has such a large impression that when some issue arises, the first response of politicians and cabinet ministers is to say, well, how will this play with the public? What do you think the public expects of us here? And it just seems so illogical, I think, to someone of my father's generation, and Menzies had that clarity.
Malcolm.
Just in relation to your father's role as Governor-General, Menzies was very critical of the appointment of Mackell as Governor-General on the basis that he was a serving politician. I think Menzies would have entertained hopes that your father would have supplanted Gordon as Prime Minister, and of course that wasn't possible once it became. Was there any discussion between them as to the distinction between Mackell's appointment and your
Just by way of background, the Chifley government appoints Mackell as Governor-General straight out of New South Wales Labor. What your father didn't approve of such appointments, and go on from there.
Yes. Well, the issue was that, yes, indeed, Mackell had been Premier of New South Wales on the Labor side, was then appointed by the Chifley government. So, of course, Casey, a former Liberal politician, had already been appointed as a earlier before my father, but Menzies was very cautious about that, and I have personal correspondence in my possession, which certainly Bolton was shown to Bolton. I just forget what use he makes of it, but Menzies did say in a quite forthright personal letter to my father, look, I've been rather silent in not very visibly and publicly congratulating you on the appointment, although I do think that you've got the qualifications and the merit for the job. But I, Menzies, am conscious of the fact that I'm on the public record concerning that Mackell previous incident, and I just think it would be hypocritical for me to repudiate what I was saying back then. So in that sense, I mean, Menzies was a very principled sort of character in being conscious of that.
Casey wasn't appointed directly from politics.
Hang on, so the suggestion is Casey wasn't appointed directly from politics, he had been...
In retirement.
Okay. Correct. Do you want to make a comment? Okay, so now we're going... It's a question here.
Nicholas, thank you for being amongst us this evening and sharing your insights. Could you tell us something about your father's family and perhaps your grandfather's family to give us a background to the Haslacks?
Question about the Haslacks, your father's family, your grandfather's family.
Okay, well, a quick overview. On the paternal side, my father's forebears had been jewellers in Hatton Garden, a small businessman in Hatton Garden, but his grandfather, Lewis Hasluck, was a slightly more adventurous soul who came out firstly to the gold rush in Victoria and then eventually came to Western Australia and held various positions. His son, therefore my grandfather and my father's father, Myrna Hasluck, as he was known, was in the postal service initially, but then when the Salvation Army began in the late 1890s, became active in Western Australia, my grandfather was recruited to that and then met and married another officer, my grandmother. And so they spent their entire life as Salvation Army officers. And in the course of doing that, they were mostly, and this bears upon some of what you've heard tonight, they were mostly had the responsibility of looking after boys' homes, sort of orphans' homes, one at Collie and one at York and other places, or even aged men's homes, the sort of thing that Salvation Army officers do. So my father grew up in that environment, particularly the boys' home at Collie, which he describes in his own autobiographical writings. So when you think about, in the assimilation era, Aboriginal people being with, mostly in the post-war era, with the consent of mothers and so forth, being removed to other places for education and indeed becoming educated in a way they would not otherwise have had the opportunity to do. It probably came out of some of my father's own personal experience in seeing that this was often the only way forward for people who would otherwise be on the scrap heap, as it were. So I hope that answers your question, and perhaps just one other element in it is that because my father came out of that Salvation Army background, he was fairly neutral in politics. His parents were probably conservative by instinct, but they just had that whole sort of outlook, as you would expect from that background, of just helping people from all stratas of society and doing what had to be done. So I think that was very fundamental to my father's sort of political egalitarian spirit.
Right, so... Stuart.
Yep. Just a little bit off the topic, but your last three novels, The Dismissal, Espionage in Gallipoli, and also the Bradshaw case in relation to Aborigines, what makes you select the topics that you wish to write about?
So why do you write about... Why do you pick the topics of the novels that you write?
Well, I suppose it probably comes partly out of the parental background I've described. I mean, my father's been in and out of so many things, and I've been helping biographers over the years looking into papers. You get fascinated by a subject. So in that novel, Dismissal, concerning the Whitlam dismissal, woven into the plot is people at the United Nations, at the San Francisco conference, and espionage, which was around in the Petrov era and so on. So they're just subjects that have fascinated me, and I've always just tried to, what shall we say, shine a light on a piece of history, which, in a way, fiction can bring to it, while as a scholar might be deterred from doing so. So again, on this book on Gallipoli, Rooms in the City, that was a espionage unit in Athens at the time of the Gallipoli campaign, and again, I had a forebear who was an anthropologist, archaeologist at the British School of Archaeology in Athens at that time, and recruited to a kind of unit of that kind. And then with this latest book, as I just said, my father, in the course of his work in the Kimberley in the 1930s, had got interested in the Aboriginal art and so forth, and I in turn have got interested in that, and it's just a fascinating subject, but now surrounded by so much political correctness, because what emerged from all the anthropologists in the 30s was that the Aboriginal people up there had absolutely no interest in this Bradshaw art, so-called Bradshaw art, because it was discovered by Joseph Bradshaw in the 1890s. They knew nothing about it. It was no part of their culture. Their culture was focused on the other Wangina images, the kind of halo-headed images. But of course, what is now taking place in the native title claim era is to try and create this sort of mythology that the Bradshaw, so-called Guian art, has always been part of the living culture, but there's nothing in the anthropological evidence to substantiate that stance. So the long short of it, in brief, I mean, I've just got fascinated in subjects and sought to bring an extra dimension to them by writing fiction, and I've never quite had the time to do a proper scholarly job, so it's perhaps a cop-out.
Yes. Well, first of all, I thought the Bradshaw case
is
a fantastic book to read.
Okay, so just speak up.
It's a wonderful book to read.
Yeah, the questioner thought the book was, the Bradshaw case is a great book to read, right. Yep.
Second thing, both Julie and I had the honour to work with your father, and I always remember him in two ways, particularly a very unpretentious man who used to drive himself to work. He had his little Peugeot car, which you think now how ministers go, when you travel overseas, you have two or three people, no more, just two or three people, and no more than that. So that was the other thing is he believed in ministerial responsibility. And some of our politicians today would be well advised to remember that.
So Geoffrey worked for your father. He regarded him as an unpretentious man, but also one very much committed to ministerial responsibility.
There's one quick comment on that. Thank you for those remarks, Geoffrey. But there's a famous story about my father in the war years, which is documented on several sources. I mean, Canberra being what it was in the war years, in fact, he rode a horse to work. I can see John Paul knows that story. And he used to tether that on Camp Hill, in fact, on Capitol Hill, I think it was, within viewing distance from West Block, where the Department of External Affairs was situated, ride home for a sandwich at lunch and that sort of thing. So, I mean, again, people of that era just came out of a different background. And what more can you say?
Paul?
I look forward to reading your Bradshaw book. Can you tell us a bit more about the approach that you've adopted? And could you comment on the extent to which the Bradshaw, the archaeology of the Bradshaws was subsumed during the whole native title debates, the terra nullius argument, etc.? It's interesting that you describe it as coming into its own more recently and being embraced by the other part of the argument about the origins of the people in this country.
Yes. Well, you can see the political implications, of course, that, I mean, in to establish a native title claim, the particular claimants have to establish a long connection with the land. And, of course, what we're now talking about also goes to the recognition issue. Because, I mean, it's part and parcel of the debate to say, look, there was just one, you know, there was a First Nation, people with First Nation status on this continent, therefore they deserve special consideration, and there is force in that argument. But the leading anthropologist, Graham Walsh, did considerable work on all this, and really came to the view that the Bradshaw art, and it's renowned for those elegant and sophisticated images which bear no relation to any other Aboriginal art anywhere, although they bear a certain resemblance to the Wayong Kulit images of Indonesia. And so Walsh advanced the thesis that there had been, as Bradshaw himself, the earlier discovery, had noticed, that these images just don't look like the present inhabitants of this space, the northwest corner. And therefore, there is the question for anthropologists and archaeologists to answer as to whether there was a different race some 17,000 years ago on this continent with this uncanny, superb skill to create these elegant images, which are quite the equal of anything in the caves of Lascaux and so on. So the whole Kimberley is a kind of an outdoor rock gallery unsurpassed anywhere in the world. But Walsh was who is now deceased, was denigrated by so many of his anthropological peers because they could see the political implications of all this. If you go to the National Museum in Canberra, and there's a certain gallery on this, you will see, and I checked it about 18 months ago, this kind of art is still described as Bradshaw art. But if you go on a tour anywhere in the Kimberley, guides now know that they must not use the term Bradshaw art. They must describe it as Gwian Gwian. And the term Gwian Gwian is really something that's only come into existence over the last 20 years or so. It's mentioned nowhere by any of the other anthropologists. And it's a means of creating a kind of a mythology that this has always been there. So there's just a huge, fascinating debate going on up there, and I just don't know where it's going to end, but this is just a way of, like any of these novels, kind of shining something of a light on it drawing out the personalities, but in the hope that if people take an interest in this, they will then go back to the scholarly art, you know, articles and the proper historians and so on. I don't pretend to have answers to this as a scholar might, nor am I advancing a particular thesis. But I am drawing attention to what I think is a very important political debate at this moment, which is hooked into this whole political correctness thing and the sort of, you know, lit cartoon and so on.
Final quick question, a quick response.
Given that national politics is conducted very much day to day, taking into account the media, the geography, the time difference, are the practical realities such that we'll never see a Western Australian Prime Minister?
We did see one.
Well, firstly, I would know from talking to Kim Beazley that one thing the West Australians have always faced is the different time frame and the excessive travel, and that certainly I know from my own boyhood experience. But to answer your question more seriously, well, I can't quite see why not. It will just depend. I think in both party rooms, West Australians have always had difficulty sort of mastering the numbers because, you know, people are just closer to those they travel with and mingle with and so on. But Kim Beazley Jr. managed it, and of course Curtin had managed it in his own time.
And Julie Bishop.
And, well, Julie Bishop is there as a senior figure who's been in the public eye for many years now. I don't know if anything like that may play out, but I think in principle there's no reason why it couldn't happen.
Many thanks, Geoffrey. So as I said before, we've got copies of Geoffrey Bolton's book, Paul Hasluck, The Life of Nicholas Hasluck's latest novel, The Bradshaw Case. Thanks for an important contribution today. Without question, John Howard's The Menzies Era is an important book, but without question there are comments to be made on it, and you've made some two very important points about Aboriginal policy through the Menzies years and Papua New Guinea policy at the same time, looked over by your father in those different portfolios at different times. So what you've given us tonight is a very important paper. It's going to live on and last because it's a significant analysis of the work of a significant politician, John Howard, who's now become a historian as well. So we're very pleased you're able to give us this paper tonight. We think highly at the Sydney Institute of your father. He spoke at the Institute about 30 years ago on Aboriginal matters, and we published that paper at the time, and he was always very helpful when to me in my work as a historian. And as Anne has pointed out in her book, Menzies and Menzies at War, that Paul Hasluck's official histories of the Australian Second World War are often overlooked these days, but they are extremely important and excellent histories of a period of Australian history between 1939 and 1945. So it's great to have you here today. You're returning today on this time talking on your father. I hope your latest novel does well, and I hope that Geoffrey Bolton's Paul Hasluck, A Life lives on. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.